Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington, working on this program via remote. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. President Salva Kiir thanks his party members for nominating him as the flag bearer for the 2025 elections.
I accept your nomination. I am humbled and honored by your decision.
And a new report by the Sentry accuses the South Sudan's National Security Service of state capture.
I think it's really a question of who is being surveilled. When it's threats to security that are being surveilled, that's one thing. But the NSS does take it a step too far.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement has endorsed President Salva Kiir as its presidential flag bearer in the country's general elections expected in late 2024. The announcement came at the end of a three-day meeting of the party's law-making organ, the National Liberation Council. Mr. Kiir welcomed the decision and pledged to work to unite and develop the country. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The SDM Political Bureau decided to nominate Comrade Salva Kiir Mayardit as the sole candidate for the position of chairman of SPLM during the third SPLM National Convention and consequently the presidential flag bearer in the national elections at the end of the transitional period.
That is Akol Paul Kordit, the SPLM's first Deputy Secretary General for Political Affairs and Organization, announcing the National Liberation Council's nomination of President Kiir as the party's presidential candidate for the general elections. The elections are to be held at the end of the transitional period in late 2024.
This is a collective decision of the SPLM Political Bureau. That tells you we have no candidate, none other than our chairman in the Political Bureau.
Party members welcomed the announcement with a standing ovation. Eastern Equatoria State Governor Louis Lobong-Lajore seconded the endorsement on behalf of the Equatoria region.
I would like to raise the emotions of a secondment of what the National Political Bureau decided to nominate Comrade Salva Kiir Mayardit as the chairperson, the candidate for the chairperson for the coming national, conventions, and subsequently the flag bearer for the coming general election.
Giving his acceptance speech, Mr. Kiir happily welcomed his endorsement as the SPLM's flag bearer.
I accept your nomination. I am humbled and honored by your decision to nominate me for these two important tasks. That is to be the only sole candidate in the forthcoming convention and becomes also the flag bearer for the SPLM party in the general election.
Among the resolutions passed during the meeting, the NLC said the Arusha Agreement reached among the factions of the SPLM in Tanzania in 2015 has been completely implemented. Another resolution approved the key documents of the party on financial management and a code of conduct and a discipline. The party also established 11 national committees to strengthen its governance policies. The National Liberation Council also called on breakaway parties, including the SPLM-IO, to relinquish the acronym SPLM and leave it with the mother party, the faction Kiir leads. Kordit warns that the SPLM could take the SPLM-IO, which Riek Machar leads, and other parties to court if they continue to use the acronym. In closing the NLC meeting, President Kiir pledged to stabilize the country and called on the South Sudanese people to work harder to build the country.
All of us, if we unite,
we leave fighting among ourselves and we work together, I believe we will be great people.
South Sudan is due to hold its first elections in late 2024, according to the new roadmap for implementing the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Udo in Juba.
A new investigative report by The Sentry says South Sudan's National Security Service has established control over the country through extensive business operations. The report documents more than 120 companies in which powerful national security personnel hold shares and enjoy regional and international connections. Sentry's researcher Lale Ahmad says the government of South Sudan should close all National Security Service detention centers and investigate allegations of torture and sexual violence. She tells Nabil Biaju the U.S. and other international actors as well as financial institutions should also identify accounts held by National Security Service personnel and target them with sanctions.
We came away with a vast network of companies with NSS shareholders across key sectors, ranging from media, logistics, natural resources, to publishing, export, import, etc. And what our investigation revealed is that the NSS in South Sudan uses a two-pronged strategy of state capture and repression to maintain the status quo.
The NSS was established in 2011 as an advisory and information gathering agency. But you seem to suggest that it has overstepped its role and its mandate. Please explain that.
I think it's really a question of who is being surveilled. When it's threats to security that are being surveilled, that's one thing. But the NSS does take it a step too far because the NSS surveils civilians, journalists, and civil society actors. And when you begin to surveil people who are key to your democracy functioning, you're definitely an obstacle to peace in your country.
You named individuals and business entities that are key actors which drive and serve the work of the NSS in South Sudan. Let's highlight some of them and their roles.
Right. So in the report, we talk, of course, about Nicole Korkuch, the Director General of the Internal Security Bureau. We talk about Akot Lalarech, who is a close associate of Salva Kiir. We talk about Jalpan Obaij, who's a legal director for the NSS. And these are all fairly senior, not only in the NSS, but also just generally in the politicking in South Sudan. But there are a number of other people that we name as well. There's Napoleon Adok Guy, who is an NSS official, who also is involved in the Ministry of Communications. There is Erjok Bullen, who's an NSS official, but was the interim director of the National Revenue Authority. And so in the report, we really try to show how NSS officials are incredibly powerful, not just in the security state, but also in every aspect of South Sudanese life.
NSS's expansive role, as you say in your report, includes media repression and controlling narratives. Please elaborate on that part.
So they do that in a couple ways. Firstly, journalists in South Sudan really aren't able to operate freely. They live in constant fear of the NSS. The NSS's involvement with journalists ranges from small things like confiscating their recording devices and stopping them from reporting on specific happenings, but it also gets pretty extreme in that journalists are often harassed and intimidated. They're often just picked up and detained for an indefinite period of time without any understanding why they're being detained or a fair trial. And in this type of environment, when journalists not only aren't able to do their job, but are also worried about their personal well-being and their families, you really don't have a space in which free press can operate freely and in a way that supports democracy. They also have a pretty big footprint in the media sector. So one of the big newspapers in Juba, the Dawn newspaper, is NSS-owned. And that's definitely a red flag. But in addition to that, NSS officials are always stationed at printing presses. So all of Juba's print newspapers go through basically an NSS review in the morning.
In your recommendations, you have a message for the government of South Sudan and one for the international community as well as financial institutions. What are the key points of what you're asking of them?
One, we feel that the government of South Sudan should immediately close NSS detention centers and release people who have not been given a fair trial. And we believe that there needs to be an objective and immediate investigation into all accusations of NSS misconduct. And then for the U.S., U.K., EU, Canada, and Australia, we feel that there should be an investigation, and then they should impose coordinated and targeted network sanctions on the individuals and entities that we mentioned in the report. Lastly, we ask that financial institutions should identify accounts held by or that benefit the members of the NSS or other politically exposed South Sudanese people. And then they should carry out a comprehensive assessment to identify the kind of broader international networks that I mentioned.
That's Lale Ahmad, a researcher with the Sentry. She was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio here in Washington. The humanitarian community in South Sudan says insecurity hampers their ability to deliver life-saving assistance. Annette Hans, the deputy head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says the continuous violence in Upper Nile has a devastating impact on residents. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Juba.
Humanitarian workers in South Sudan says continuing violence in Upper Nile State is appalling and devastates the lives and livelihoods of residents. Annette Hans is the deputy head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, or UN OCHA. She says more than 9,100 people have been displaced following the recent surge in violence in Pashoda County of Upper Nile State.
The ongoing insecurity is hampering the ability of humanitarian partners to deliver life-saving assistance to thousands of people and has forced partners to put much-needed assessments on hold. In some areas, the violence has resulted in the relocation of humanitarian workers, looting of humanitarian facilities and supplies, and movement restrictions across Fashoda and Manyo counties.
Hans says the clashes that broke out in mid-November between armed groups resulted in civilian death and injuries. She says the fighters have abducted women and children, destroyed property and livelihoods. There also are reports of violence targeted at women.
Over 2,300 people arrived to the Malakal Protection of Civilians site, the POC, since the start of the crisis. This surge of new arrivals puts additional pressure on the already limited capacity of the partners to provide services to support them, with limited space for them to stay. As the conflict extended, an estimated 5,000 people displaced from Malut County to Manyo County. According to the local responders, at least 75% of the newly displaced are women and children, with many children separated from their caregivers.
Han says there are also reports of a significant number of people crossing into Sudan, while others are hiding in swamps. Han says Peter Bander Huarat, the interim humanitarian coordinator in South Sudan, is calling for an end to the fighting.
The humanitarian coordinator at interim, Mr. Van der Aert, is urging the government and local authorities to ensure safe and unimpeded access for humanitarian partners to all those in need, and called upon the parties to the conflict to cease all violence and in all circumstances act in full respect of international humanitarian law.
She says the displaced people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance, including food, water, sanitation and hygiene facilities, health care, mental health and psychosocial support. Last week, the African Union mission in South Sudan, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the Troika and the European Union and others called on the South Sudan government to engage with the armed groups in the conflict to end the violence. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, some Sudanese activists hail Sudan's latest agreement with caution. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you do when you are in a bad mood?
I usually would move away from the environment of the agitation and then get a quiet place and pray. Usually when I'm done praying, the agitation and the stress, I get some amount of relief.
Sometimes I decide to sleep and maybe read a novel that can make my mind come like back to normal. Yeah, that's what I normally do.
I rather stay alone and I listen to music, uplifting music, music that has good lyrics that would uplift my spirit.
Okay, when I'm in the bad mood, I sometimes play video games just to make me feel happy.
Actually, I call mom, I talk to her, tell her what's disturbing me. She advises me then, you stay down there.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Some Sudanese women activists are hailing the country's civilian forces and the military for reaching a framework agreement toward establishing a civilian-led transitional government. Some activists, however, express concern about women's participation during the transition period, saying the 40% share of power allocated to women should be fully implemented without failure. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Sudanese civilian groups under the umbrella of Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition and the military signed a framework agreement early this week that paves the way for formation of civilian-led transitional government. The move raises hope of ending the long confrontation between pro-democracy protesters and the security forces. Some Sudanese women rights activists hail parties to the agreement and saying, if implemented, the deal will end the deaths of pro-democracy protesters in the military crackdowns. Inas Muzamil, a woman rights activist and an executive member of Medani organization, says the agreement is a good step toward establishing a civilian-led transitional government. She says the agreement is a result of months of continued pressure from women, youth groups and civilian political forces on the military leaders who, she says, hijacked the aspirations of the Sudanese people for a democratic civilian-led transition.
The military understand that they should be under the command of a civilian ministry of defense. And the second important thing is that they will not enter into commercial businesses other than those related to their military work.
The framework agreement stipulates that women shall hold at least 40% of positions in government institutions at all levels. Muzamil says allocating this percentage for women alone is not enough, saying there is a lot of work to be done.
We need comprehensive legal reforms and the abolition of discriminatory laws, including personal status and nationality laws. At the same time, we need mass action to raise awareness among societies about women's political, civil, and social rights.
Speaking to South Sudan in Focus in Khartoum, Ehsan Abdallah, the head of No to Women Oppression Initiative, describes the framework agreement as a beginning of a long journey towards achieving democracy. She says the parties to the agreement need to hold their promise and complete the process.
This is a parliamentary framework agreement, and we are looking forward to a final deal that shall address five critical issues. Most importantly, the issue of transitional justice. Until all the revolutionary forces reach a final agreement, there should be no any kind of attack on the protesters during this period.
Abla Karar, a woman leader with Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition, says the agreement is legal because it has won the confidence of many groups, including women. She describes the agreement as a victory of civilian forces against the military coup last year.
All the forces that signed this agreement represent a wider range of different current Sudanese revolutionary forces who have rejected the October military coup since day one.
The framework agreement calls for immediate security and military reforms. Among the reforms is the reunification of all militias, including the Sudan paramilitary rapid support forces, into one unified army. It also stresses the need to resolve issues regarding transitional justice in the country. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The UN Refugee Agency warns the humanitarian conditions are worsening for tens of thousands of Somalis in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camps as unrelenting drought grips the Horn of Africa and funding drips up. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 80,000 Somalis fleeing conflict and drought have arrived in Kenya's Dadaab refugee camps over the past 2 years, more than 24,000 since September. This is exacting an enormous burden on the local communities and refugees already living in the camps, which house an estimated 230,000 refugees. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports refugees, especially those who have arrived since the end of September, are in urgent need of assistance. It says shelter for the new arrivals is running out. This is forcing many to live in makeshift shelters with limited or no access to clean water and sanitation. To make matters worse, UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshyakov says a cholera outbreak at the end of October has infected more than 350 people, mainly children. He says the spread of cholera is declining thanks to the efforts of health partners. However, the risk of further infection remains.
UNHCR is providing new arrivals to Dadaab with clean drinking water and extending sanitation and hygiene facilities to the outskirts of the camps. We are also providing targeted protection services for the most vulnerable to ensure their needs are met. Malnourished children are being screened and admitted to stabilization centers.
He notes the UNHCR also is assisting nearby host communities. It is rehabilitating boreholes, providing generators for water pumps, and trucking in water. While tending to the immediate needs of the refugees and local populations, he says the UNHCR and Kenyan government are seeking long-term solutions for this intractable problem. Kenya has been hosting more than 500,000 refugees and asylum seekers in Dadaab and Kakuma refugee camps and urban areas for over 3 decades. This is the second largest number in Africa after Ethiopia. Cheshikov says neither voluntary repatriation to Somalia nor resettlement in third countries of asylum are viable solutions currently.
What we are focusing on now is to find ways for refugees to become self-reliant in Kenya. And that includes through education, through vocational training, and through access to financial services so that people can start businesses, so that they have a prospect as a longer-term solution is found to their plight.
In the meantime, the UNHCR warns its life-saving operations for more than 257,000 drought-affected people in Kenya is foundering for lack of financial support. It notes only half of an appeal issued in June for $11.1 million has been met. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The M23 rebel group operating in the Democratic Republic of Congo says it will withdraw from territories it seized in the past year of fighting the Congolese army and respect recently declared ceasefire. Mohammed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
The M23 rebel group says it is withdrawing from positions in North Kivu province, the epicenter of the fighting that continually troubles the eastern DRC. An M23 spokesman, Lawrence Kanyuka, says the areas under its control are constantly attacked by militia groups and government forces. He says East Africa regional forces need to follow up on their proposal to give peace a chance.
We can withdraw, but
We want to have a meeting. We have invited the force, East African force, and the joint verifications mechanism to come to have a meeting with us in a way to see the modality and the implementation of the said withdrawal. At the same time, I told you as well, we have requested a meeting with the facilitation and the mediators. And at the same time as well, entire dialogue with the DRC government.
Fighting has raged in North and South Kivu despite recent ceasefire declarations signed in Angola and Kenya. There was no immediate government reaction to the M23 statement. The rebel group has not been invited to recurring peace talks in Nairobi, and authorities in Kinshasa have been reluctant to engage with the rebel group since a previous ceasefire agreement in 2013 failed. The East African Community Regional Bloc has thousands of troops deployed in eastern DRC, attempting to quell the conflict there and disarm scores of armed groups. The force commanders say they were targeting more than 130 armed groups in the region. Kanyuka says people have been fleeing to M23-controlled areas to seek refuge from government forces.
What is happening? We are under attack constantly, as I told you. And we have families that are running away from these attacks that need support because they are living in entities that belong to us in the moment. And we want them to actually be looked after, like those who ran away as well on the other side of the government control areas. So these are human people. These are actually lives that need to be saved. So the most important things in the present time is to cater for them and to get some support for them and family.
The conflict in eastern Congo between the Congolese forces and the M23 has an ethnic component. The rebel group says it is protecting Tutsi minority tribes that are killed and displaced in the region. With elections just a year away, some experts say President Félix Tshisekedi is treading carefully about how he deals with armed groups for fear of losing voters. Mohamed Yesu for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Stop a la Guerre by Fally Poupa.
Stop a la guerre, stop a la guerre, stop a la guerre. Stop a la guerre, stop a la guerre.
Been listening to Fally Poupa and the song Stop a la Guerre. I'm your host John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.